Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC, offering a broad range of cardiac and vascular treatments in our community. More information is available at upmc.com/centralpaheart.
Welcome to The Spark. I'm Scott Lamar. New York Times bestselling author Eric Larson has written 9 mostly nonfiction books about history that gives the reader the sense that they're witnessing the scenes firsthand that he's writing about. His books have been described as reading like fiction, even though they are about events that actually occurred. A quote from a book review in the New York Times said, "Mr. Larson occupies a rare niche of historical writers whose books seem to straddle the high and low end of the nonfiction market, reaching the masses, but also attracting scholarly attention and landing in college and high school curriculums." Eric Larson will appear as part of the York County History Center's Distinguished Speaker Series at the Appel Center for the Performing Arts in York on April 18th. Eric Larson joins us on The Spark today. Eric Larson, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That New York Times description had me wondering, who do you write for? Do you have a specific audience in mind when you're writing?
Actually, I do have a very specific audience in mind when I'm writing, and that specific audience is my wife. She's an academic scientist. She's a physician, but she's an avid reader, and she reads the kind of things that I like to read. And when I write, I have her specifically in mind. Like she's the reader who I'm going to try to lure into a subject that she might not otherwise have been particularly interested in. And if I can do that with her, then I think I can do that with a pretty broad swath of audience. That's what I'm after, is the broadest possible audience. I'm not writing for scholars, but I'm also not, I'm not gonna write something that they're not gonna like also. But it's really for this broad audience who I can just sort of invite into my world for however long it takes to read the book.
So how many edits or how often does your wife edit your material?
she is my first and last reader. That is to say, I don't show her things as I'm going along. I don't want her to suffer that much. I give her the sort of second to last final draft, because her big strength for me is in isolating the things in that draft that need to be removed, and also in indicating to me which things are particularly good, which is also very helpful. So that final read, and she does that through symbols in the margins. You know, an up arrow means I keep it, down arrow means I get rid of it. Smiley face is really good, sad face is really good, with little tears streaming down, you know, that's very good. The troubling things are the long periods of Z's, you know, long strains of Z's in the margin, which suggests that, you know, this border to death. And then also segments in where she doesn't mark anything in the margin. Then I think, oh, fine, she skipped, you know. But anyway, so it's very, 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 very helpful, because, you know, I try to pack everything into that final draft, everything that I think is it, you know, that I wouldn't mind seeing in print the very next day. But she helps rein me in. She helps remind me what's good. She helps remind me also what things are emotionally powerful. Because by the time you're done with a book after 3 or 4 years, something that moved you, you know, 4 years ago has ceased to move you. And so it helps to be reminded by a fresh reader that, oh yeah, that was very moving.
I always wonder whether the reading public realize how much research, how much time, how much effort goes into writing a book. You just said, gave an example of something that moved you 4 years ago. Does it take that long?
Yeah, it does take that long. I'm talking about from start to finish, like from the beginning of the proposal process. I do a book proposal for every book, even though my agent tells me, look, just write a letter, you know, but the proposals are basically for me. So that I'm pretty sure before I get a contract from my publisher, I'm pretty confident that there's actually a book there. But anyways, from the beginning to end, the process takes about 4 years. Now, what my hope is, I don't want readers to have to constantly appreciate how much research has been done. I mean, I want the reading experience to be pretty much invisible. But anybody who wants to pursue things further can go to my footnotes. And actually, if they go to the footnotes, because I know that there are a lot of footnote junkies out there, and I count myself as one, I always salt my footnotes with extra little stories that I just could not get into the book, or stories that my wife made me take out, but I was like, yeah, they're going in somewhere and they're going in the footnotes. So,
you know, you create a dilemma for me sometimes with those footnotes, because, okay, where do I stop here in the page and go to the footnote, read the footnote? Do I stop here? You know, it's a big decision, Eric.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sorry I put you through that. No, but really, the way I do footnotes, I prefer to call them source notes, because they are not literally footnotes. I mean, there's a number of ways to do footnotes. The classic way is to have little numbers in the text and then the footnote at the bottom of the page, or maybe the footnote at the back, but still with that little number. I never use those little numbers, because little numbers are automatically distracting. Those are like a little signpost that says, okay, now you can leave the text, go to the footnote, read it, come back. My hope is that the reading experience is more or less immersive, and that you're not going to feel like absolutely drawn to go to the source notes. But if you do feel compelled to go, I try to make it pretty easy to find where they are in that collection of source notes at the back of the book.
I'm curious, which of your books took the most research?
Which took the most research? I don't think I've ever been asked that question, actually, in a couple of decades of writing books. But I don't think I can isolate that. Every book, no matter how expansive or not expansive the subject matter is, involves a lot of fine-grained research. Maybe, you know, I'd have to say, I guess, that the recent book, The Splendid and the Vile, about Winston Churchill, I have to say, maybe I would say that involved the most research, mainly because the guy is one of the most written about people in the world. You know, I would say Churchill, Lincoln, and Hitler, you know, are probably the three people who have been most heavily written about. And in order to say something smart, or rather not stupid, about somebody like Winston Churchill, you got to do a lot of reading. And so I had to do an awful lot of reading. However, I did tell myself, look, there's no way I can read everything about Churchill. Even if I did try to read everything that's currently published about Churchill, by the time I was done, literally another 50 books would probably have been done about the guy, and I'd start all over. I mean, reading about Churchill scholarship is like painting a bridge. You know, the minute you're done with the bridge, you got to start repainting it. So in that case, I mean, I simply resolved, okay, I got to get a sense of the landscape, and then I go into the archives to pursue the particular area of my interest, which was how on a day-by-day basis, Churchill and his family and his close advisors, who were like family, how they got through the German air campaign of that first year of World War II.
You know, I have to say that you know, more than 80 years after the Blitz on Britain, your book got people talking about Churchill again. I mean, we've always held him up as a hero of World War II, but there seems to be even more respect for him today, and I think that can be attributed to your book, because it brought so much attention to Winston Churchill.
Well, you know, that'd be nice if that were the case. I think Churchill is, for many people, infinitely interesting. Whether you know, we talked about my audience earlier. I mean, whether that broad audience, you know, was dying to read about Churchill or not, I don't know. But hopefully, I lured them in and gave them a story that was quite fresh in terms of Churchill historiography. And it's not easy to do, let me just tell you. But You know, whether I helped put him back on the map or not, I don't know. I think actually there was a confluence of things. You know, when that book came out, when we launched that book, that was in February of 2020. I was out on my book tour. I was halfway through when the pandemic reached the point where everything was starting to shut down. I remember flying home on March 12th, which coincidentally is my wife's birthday, when everything was shutting down, came back to New York. And I figured, okay, that's the end of this book, right? But then a really interesting thing happened. People came to the book, believe it or not. You know, this is a book about murder, carnage, and so forth. And people came to this book for solace in the midst of the pandemic, because it showed them a way to think about their experience. You know, here's this world of the past that where they went through something incredibly horrible, you know, on a day-by-day basis, and nonetheless survived, and did so in large part because of this really charismatic leader, this guy Winston Churchill. And by reading about Winston Churchill, it sort of helped them get away from the leadership vacuum, which we actually had to deal with, I argue, with the pandemic. And suddenly Churchill became kind of a god again, you know? And then another weird thing, another wave of things happened, another wave of things happened, and that was the Black Lives Matter movement. Then suddenly Churchill took a nosedive, you know, because, you know, he was in fact a 19th century imperialist, and arguably at different phases of his life and certainly acted or spoke as if he were, as if he had racist inclinations. I would argue in the case of this period, there was nothing racist about him or his rhetoric during at least this period. But suddenly he took a little nosedive. But then he came back again because of the Ukraine war, and everybody sort of started making parallels between Churchill and Yeltsin. You know, so it's like there's such a weird wave, such a roller coaster.
Our guest today is best-selling author Eric Larson. He will be appearing as part of the York County History Center's Distinguished Speaker Series at the Appel Center for the Performing Arts in York on April 15th. What time did you get up this morning?
First, before anything else, may I correct myself? I identified the president of the Ukraine as Yeltsin. I meant Zelensky. So
we were going back a few years, yeah.
Yeah. This morning I got up later than usual. I got up at 5.
Okay. And then what did you do after that?
Oh, okay. Well, you want everything?
No. No. So, the reason I'm asking this question is because you have a ritual, ritual about writing, correct?
Yes. So my routine is I get up, I make coffee, and then, you know, I sit down at my desk. I have I always have my Oreo cookie. It's a, you know, double stuff Oreo cookie.
Wow, double.
Stuff is spelled, by the way, with one F, not sure why, but it's one F. I have my double stuff Oreo with my cup of black coffee. And then I start writing. I work until I have till breakfast, which can be, you know, depends on the day. I mean, I could have breakfast at 9, 10, whatever. And then take a break. And then if I'm in peak writing period, like I am now, working toward a deadline, I will get back actually to the hardcore writing. Although I always make it a point to stop when I'm ahead. I don't binge write. The worst thing I think a writer can do is like write from 8 until 7 o'clock that day and just like think, oh God, this was a great productive day. Problem is you write from 8 till 7 and you try to get up the next morning and start over. It's tough. So I often end in mid-paragraph, mid-sentence, because then instantly the next morning I'm productive. I finish the sentence, I finish the paragraph. But because of the miracle of the human brain, overnight, you know, we don't like things. The brain does not like things to be incomplete. Neither does the IRS, by the way. But the brain does not like to have things incomplete. And so overnight, even though I'm not even aware of it, my brain will be finishing that sentence, will be finishing that paragraph, that page, whatever. And also then taking the subject matter even further. So when I sit down and I finish that sentence the next morning with my coffee and my Oreo cookie, I finish that sentence, I finish that paragraph, but I also know pretty much where I'm going for the next few hours because of that power of the human mind.
Does it feel like a job?
No. That's a good question. You know, I call it work. I treat it as one would a daily job. I mean, I get up like this every single day of the year, except maybe Christmas. You know, I try to give myself a day off on Christmas. It's funny. I never really have thought of it as a job.
You've written about serial killers. You mentioned Winston Churchill, Europe before World War I and World War II, a hurricane, a gun. How do you decide what to write about?
Yeah, I wish I knew. That sounds glib, but it's actually truer than I would like it to be. When I finish a book and I start looking for the next book, it takes me a long time. It takes me about a year sampling ideas, thinking about things, testing ideas. It is not at all a natural process. You know, there is no 3D printer that will help me just, you know, come up with some great new idea. I always have to, even if I have a subject in mind, yeah, there are topics and then there are ideas. You know, topics are, you know, anybody can come up with a topic. I had a guy come up to me once and say, you know, this year, it wasn't this year, it was like before the pandemic, said, you know, this year is the 100th anniversary of the auto industry. You should write a book about that. And I was like, well, okay, well, you know, what's the story? What story am I writing about that whole topic? So I really have to test my ideas. And I have certain criteria that they have to meet. For example, if I come up with an idea for something, it's something about the event or the period that I'm writing about has to have a natural narrative arc, a natural narrative engine that will draw readers along because of the inherently suspenseful nature of the event. For example, the sinking of the Lusitania. Mm-hmm.
Dead Weight was the book.
To,
yeah.
Has to have that which was another book that I'd done. It has to have that central narrative arc. It has to be something I'm interested in that I'm willing to spend, you know, 4 years on. But it also has to have probably the single most important thing, because this is what's referred to as narrative history. You can't make it up. You have to have the details that let you tell the story as if it were fiction. I use fictional techniques, but my books are completely nonfiction. But in order to be able to do that, you have to have the fine grain material that lets you tell a story in a rich way, telegrams, memoirs, diaries, and so forth. So I evaluate the idea also to see how rich a reservoir and how deep of archival materials there is on the subject. And if all those things check off, then I do a book proposal. And by the end of the book proposal, I'm either pretty confident that I have a book, or that it's not going to happen. I mean, I actually killed a book. I had just done like a 125 single space page proposal on a book, including a capital outline of it, and I just hit send, just sent it to my agent. When I suddenly realized I didn't want to do it, that it lacked something, and I'm still hard pressed to even think about what it was about that book that made me not want to do it. But the best thing I could come up with afterwards was it lacked heart. So I got on the phone to my agent afterwards, you know, like 5 minutes later, and I just said, "Look, I'm not doing it."
Can you tell us what the book was about?
Yeah, I don't mind telling you. I'm not going to do it now. Although, you know, never say never. The book was about the central character was William Mulholland, who was the water czar in California back in, you know, the turn of the last century. And at one point, he was considered the single most important man in the country. But there was an event. If you saw the film Chinatown, you know, Mulholland's in the film Chinatown. But if you saw the film Chinatown, there was a glancing reference to the thing that I was going to write about, which is the the collapse of the St. Francis Dam, which was part of his water network. This dam collapsed and killed 500 people in 1928, I think. And it was the thing that destroyed Mulholland's career. This guy, it was talking about hubris. This guy had risen to the absolute heights. Then here was this dam built in the wrong place, built shoddily, and it destroyed his career. Mm.
Just weren't feeling it, huh?
Just wasn't feeling it.
We only have about a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You know, something you touched on, and I hate to do this briefly, but something you touched on, you have said that when you write quotes, when someone is quoted in your books, they've actually said it. You don't try to read into their minds or paraphrase or anything like that.
No, then you move into the realm of fiction. I always have an introductory note in my books that anything between quotes is from some kind of living historical document. Mm.
Is that unusual for nonfiction books?
You know, I think no. I mean, I think it's more. I think it's more common to be that careful now than I think it was, because I think audiences have come to expect it. I've always been that way. I've always felt that you had to absolutely, anything between quotes, that it had to absolutely be the real deal. Otherwise you're making it up. Mm-hmm. But I think there was for a while, and some people still do it. Some people still want to put in, you know, composite characters or imagined dialogue. But you know, you can't. In my view, you can't do it. Nor do you have to do it.
Eric Larson will be in York for the York County History Center's Distinguished Speaker Series at the Appel Center for the Performing Arts on April 18th. Thank you very much. I'll see you then.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to The Spark on WITF, your home for NPR and discovering all things local. I'm Scott Lamar.